The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Green Front. As we wind up the year 2011 and looking forward to 2012, we're going to stop and chat with some friends, our neighbors to the north in Canada. I had the occasion to be in Thunder Bay, Ontario, back in early October. Got to give a talk there to a Go Green Day, and was very pleased to meet Lynn Palmer at that event, and then later connected with Scott Kyle, and both of them are kind enough to be joining me today from Ontario, the Thunder Bay area, to talk about some of the issues going on in Canada. We're going to start with, of course, Canada pulling out of Kyoto. That, of course, an international story. But Lynn Palmer is active in forestry issues and climate change issues. She's been very discouraged with what's going on, trying to save the boreal forest. But, of course, like all of us activists, you got to get up the next day and keep fighting the good fight. And we're going to talk about some of the Green Party activity that they're both involved in up in Canada. And she's participated in several United Nations conferences on issues like forestry, climate change, and biodiversity. And along with her, my new friend, Scott Kyle. He is a leader in the Green Party up there in Canada, also a very active environmental leader and also a radio host. I was pleased to have been on his program a few months back, and now I'm returning the honor and pleased to have you both with me, Lynn Palmer and Scott Kyle. Welcome to the Green Front.
Thanks, Betsy.
Thank you, Betsy.
Now, when I was doing a little bit of research, I was hoping that I would find that Canada was much more proactive and that your government was more enlightened than ours. I have to admit I was not paying close attention, only to find that the Harper government is almost as bad as our George Bush administration was. Not that we've seen enough action from the Obama administration, but hopefully that's changing. Of course, the Keystone issue connects Canada and the U.S. very much so, and I would love to hear your thoughts on the latest there, as well as just some regional issues, local issues that you're fighting, you know, as a part of the Green Party and just as individuals. So let's start with, first of all, the Kyoto decision. How upsetting is that? What has been the response among fellow Ontarians and Canadians?
Yeah.
And what's your take? Go ahead and begin, Scott.
Okay, Betsy, thanks. It's distressing for in the circles, certainly, that I hang in. People sort of, you know, at the grassroots level, are talking about it lots, and we have a reputation almost mythological at this point in Canada, being fairly green. We have a fairly intact environment, and we've generally through the decades taken a peaceful approach to world politics and so on. But the sort of withdrawal from the Kyoto Accord is very distressing to most of us who are concerned with kind of evolving the way society develops. We've had a swing away from traditional sort of liberal governments in the wake of the Trudeau politics back in the 60s and early 70s to a gradual dawning of a conservative era. And there's not much in the conservative constitution that I can see that is environmentally friendly at all. Part of Canada's problem is that it's remained largely a resource extraction and a primary industry type of country in its economic policy and approach, and we haven't gone all that well into manufacturing. So, and as you know, resource extraction and exportation itself is problematic for the environment. But it's purely and simply a political, a bad political decision on the part of the Harper government. It's very distressing amongst those who are aware and concerned.
And Lynn, I'd like to get your thoughts. And was it primarily to avoid fines, you know, for not complying with Kyoto? Was that the, what reasons were given when that decision was announced?
Folks like myself would say a spin on this, you know, a big claim by our federal minister of environment with this conservative government that it's going to cost us so much money, you know, if we stay in $14 billion. We don't feel that's the case at all, that wouldn't happen, that's not the way it functions. You know, there's a lot of, I would say, well, we would probably think real reasons that it's happening. I mean, Canada does tend to, in general, not with everything by any means, but there's, and this government is saying, well, you know, we're not going to do anything. You know, we've got the big neighbor, the U.S. Hey, if they're not in it, you know, there's that attitude now. But when it really comes down to it, as Scott mentioned, we do resource extraction, and as you know, and you've talked about a lot, the big one is the tar sands. That and then our transportation sector, just with the size of the country, we could change our direction, absolutely, and we could get into that, but this government, they're just total supporters of this.
And what would you say the response has been on the part of Canadian citizens? I'm sure it's, you know, perhaps divided. We certainly are very polarized here in this country on environmental issues right now, and we'll be talking about that more in the second half of the show with Ken Silver, who is a Republican, moderate Republican, a friend of our favorite moderate Republican climate activist, E.R. Tucker. He's going to talk about, you know, how we can, you know, bring this divide together because it's so counterproductive. But back to Canada. Tell us, you know, among fellow citizens, what kind of, was there a response? Maybe people like here are not all that tuned into their environment.
Well, there definitely is a divide. As Scott mentioned, those of us, you know, more on the green, the progressive end, it's just really, really disheartening, really frustrating. But I did look at a few comments. You know, this has just been announced very recently, since the Durban meeting, the climate change conference, and I was looking at a little bit online at some of the responses, and I was quite shocked to see a lot of responses saying, hey, that's great, the Kyoto is a protocol, doesn't work anyway, it's a waste of time, because we did get, our federal election was last spring in May, early May, and we do have a majority government here with the Conservative government. It's not a majority of Canadians, but it's close to 40% of the population who did support that direction. So I don't know if they all feel that way about the Kyoto Protocol, but there were a lot of comments saying, hey, that's great, because there's so much spin from the government that it's not a good deal, that it doesn't work, that, you know, it's going to cost us money, that there are other countries like the U.S. and others, right? Russia, China, they're not in it yet, so what's the point? I would say it's quite divided, and then I think there's a lot of the apathy out there, too, as you mentioned, you know, that people who just really don't pay attention, and I don't know what the numbers are, maybe.
And before we get to some of your local and regional issues, and Scott, you can go ahead and respond to that, and then I'd like to, you know, this touches on the Keystone controversy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, you mentioned the local thing, and you're trying to get a finger on the pulse of everyday people's reaction to this. I don't hear direct reactions to the Kyoto withdrawal or the intention on the part of our government to do so. But it sort of depends on which little political circle you're hanging in. There is a fair bit of complacency and indifference toward hardcore environmental issues north of the border. I would think in many ways to some extent to the same degree, I would think, because in North America there's, and if I may kind of go touch on this direction first locally, we in this Northwest Ontario region of Thunder Bay at the top of the Great Lakes here, where we are, we're mainly all about forestry and mining traditionally. And again, that's resource extraction. Well, those resources have been vastly and largely depleted, and our economy suffers greatly around here. And we've got big box stores that have sprung up on the landscape like mushrooms. And we know that a lot of those products in those stores are as a result of the offshore labor and so on. And as I heard in the blurb at the beginning of your program, you know, what happened to American ingenuity and good old Yankee know-how and production, and those sorts of sentiments, and I agree with that. I'm just old enough to remember America that was in full production, and it could be even much more proud of our American neighbors. And I think it's again, it's partly politics, but it's partly social philosophy and what we're going to do as communities to reinvent ourselves and to keep it local. I think to a great extent we have to accept some of the responsibility in allowing these corporations to go offshore and to pressure them to. I think the new democratic vote, Betsy, is where we shop, where and how much we shop.
Mm. Make a vote with your money, with your purse. So that's exactly mm-hmm. right. And, you know, Canada is, you know, known for its extractive industries, mm-hmm. and that is mining, it's timber, it's also oil. Why do you think they're going after the tar sands? Is that it's certainly not the low-hanging fruit. Is that an indication to you, as it seems to be to me, that we're, you know, either at peak oil or past peak oil, you know,
yeah.
going after the, like we did with the you know, Deepwater Horizon's disaster, you know, a mile out, digging
yeah.
for oil, drilling for oil. This seems to be kind of a desperate attempt
it
to
get
oil, and yet they're trying to, the industry, of course, the oil, fossil fuel industry, trying to normalize this, trying to say, hey, there's no more emissions doing this and normal drilling processes, which is not correct, not truthful, and also just to make it sound like it'll all be about jobs, good things, and they're, of course, spending millions, I'm sure, on ads up there, as they certainly are here. To say that this is something we need.
Well, we were taught. I remember being taught as early as way back in grade 10 and 11 geography that the extraction of the oil from the tar sands in northern Alberta was not feasible because of the ratio of the energy input to energy output. In other words, it really does cost a third of a barrel of oil to extract that oil from which is embedded throughout the actual sands.
You sure had an enlightened geography teacher to be talking about that way back then. We're still trying to get that message out now.
Yeah. So that's the first thing that has to be understood. And I like your term. Is it the low-hanging fruit? Well, it certainly isn't from that perspective that I've just outlined there, the energy ratio. But it is in the sense that it's being termed by the industry as a mining operation because it's at the surface, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an extrusion of oil that has seeped to the surface in more ancient times, but become embedded in the sands, in a sandy area. So it has to be steamed to be removed. So you've got this gaping hole in the earth where it's taken out by whatever machining process, and then it's steamed out of the sands, and then you have these massive, beautiful white piles of sand that we could probably go around and make new beaches around the world with. Maybe that's a use for them, but. I'm being facetious.
Funny and not funny, right?
No. So, but it really comes down to, and then people will say, you know, those that are not so accepting of the environmentalists will say, well, we're all in this together. We're all consumers, and the oil barons, the oil spokespersons say, I've noticed you're still pulling up to the pumps. And you know, I get this. There's no us and them. I understand that fully, but. We want alternative mechanisms within society to make us less reliant on cars, such as proper and up-to-date public transit systems, not only within the urban environments, but across Canada.
And
there's very little willpower for that.
And since I don't know what the ratio is of how many jobs would be created in Canada versus the United States if Keystone is allowed to go forward, what kinds of estimates of jobs that will be created or distortion of same have you seen up there?
Well, I mean, you're not really. There's a paucity of those kinds of estimates. Again, because the political milieu of the day is not to make those projections. It's just to bury your head in the tar sands, so to speak. You got this black-headed ostrich, you know.
Good line.
But no. The thing is, as well as I do, the green front industry would be massive right throughout North America and beyond into the world. If we really did invest in a so-called green economy that invests in things like public transit and local greenhouses and local food and keeping things back down to a local level, I think that an infrastructure of transportation that respects the environment can still be in place. But we need to look back at trains. I believe in rails quite a bit.
And, you know, did word of the protests at the White House a few months back really reach Canadian mainstream with NASA scientist James Hansen saying something that's been oft repeated, very dramatic comment that if President Obama okays the Keystone Pipeline, and, of course, a lot of emphasis on the fact that he alone can make that decision, not with Congress's input, that it will be, quote, game over for the environment, for the climate. Does that kind of news reach mainstream Canadians?
It does, and in fact, of course, those like folks like us, you know, we celebrated what happened there in early November. On the other side, the other thing going around is the response that, well, you know, then we'll just take it elsewhere. That it will not be corked. You know, that the oil sands will not be corked. So, again, there's this divided. You know, there's probably apathy and those who aren't engaged. But in those who are aware and engaged, there's the two sides very much. That this is going ahead no matter, you know, what the U.S. does, and I could get into what the thinking is and what the proposals are for that, you know, to take it to Asia as an alternative. So,
which does not sound very environmentally friendly either. What are they going to do a pipeline between China and the United States? I mean, are they going to ship it? It's just...
A pipeline west. What's the proposal now is an Enbridge project to put it west. Through the Rocky Mountains, through British Columbia to the coast, and then the oil tankers would take it to Asia. So that is definitely in the work. So
it's hard, and Betsy, if I may interject for a second, Lynn, it's hard to know which is more disastrous as a pipeline route. I mean, I'm not supportive of long pipelines at all, but what would be more disastrous, one that was proposed straight south to the Gulf through your territory, or west through the Rockies, which is more, in some ways, could even be more expensive and invasive through a Rockies route, or down south in somewhere in the vicinity of what is well known to be the San Andreas Fault. You know, I mean, come on, folks.
Yeah, that's right where I live, right there on that fault. And when I was up there, I was impressed with Thunder Bay. They're really proactive on the environment. I was speaking on behalf of the city of Thunder Bay, so they, of course, gave me a nice presentation of what they're doing, and I was impressed. Are they known throughout Ontario as being a leader on the green front?
You know, I would say not necessarily. Again, I mean, I can take you up and show you vast clear-cut areas in the surrounding Thunder Bay area in the boreal forest, and I can take you to some areas that have been cut so radically that there are sand dunes developing.
Maybe that's why they're more proactive, at least in the city center, taking action.
Yeah, that's right. Because
there's an effort being made.
The city is the municipality, and so what Scott's talking about, that's a different jurisdiction. That's the province that deals with everything outlying, which is public land. But you're right in the city, they have made strides to get an environmental action plan, and they've modeled that on, like, to some extent, on some other cities. So, but the north in general, when I say north, we have two kind of domains in Ontario. We have the north and the south. Quite different situations. The North isn't really known for being overly progressive, but yes, some strides are being made, and it is positive, like what you saw that's happening here, just within the city limits.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk in a moment, Lynn, about some of the battles you've been fighting, but Scott, you're active in the Green Party. Is that kind of a marginalized party like it is in this country, I suspect? How large, how active, growing?
We're a tiny little nucleus of those of us who meet regularly at meetings are about 15 strong here in a
that many, huh? 1-5
in a population of 113,000 here in Thunder Bay, but we're a disenfranchised little lot. We're part of the Green Tea Party.
All right. For those of us who are seeing that they're playing politics with our planet on both sides of the border, I welcome Canadian members. We need all the members we can get. Stay tuned for that. And so the Green Party politics is probably pretty much like it is here, marginalized.
It is. But Betsy, there has been actually this year in our federal government. We have made some strides. So there's two things. There's the federal party, and then each province, if they have one, has its own. So we're members of both the Ontario Party, which is our province, and then the National Green Party of Canada. Green Party of Canada this year, again, I mentioned our federal election was back in early May of 2011. our leader, who is Elizabeth May, she was elected. She is now a member of Parliament. So this we made history. So in some ways, it dropped. I think 4 years ago, our previous election, it was up at what, Scott, something like maybe 10% or 8%. But it did drop way down to about 3% in that election. Probably, everybody says, because of the recession. You know, everybody's focused on jobs, less on the environment. But Elizabeth May did get elected. So she's on the West Coast, near on Vancouver Island, in a very progressive, we call them ridings here, and so she beat the Conservative incumbent, so it was phenomenal. So a lot of the effort for the election went in, so people like Scott who are running, we wanted those candidates all across the country, but that helped support that movement, so it's kind of a mix. I mean, she's there, she was at the climate change conference, she used to be head of the Sierra Club of Canada, so that's actually positive. A lot maybe can't happen yet, but it does set a precedent.
When you say the climate change conference, you're talking about the one in Durban?
In Durban, yeah. Elizabeth was there. So as a member of Parliament and the leader of the Green Party of Canada.
And as you may know, Betsy, the Green Party is, I try to remind this, remind people of this when I'm speaking of it, it's much more than just ecological and environmental concerns. It's looking toward a brighter, more democratic future, sort of what I call the restoration of participatory democracy. We got to get people involved, and we got to get our own politicians involved in generating and maintaining. Democracy can't just kind of happen on its own. Hmm. So Elizabeth May, our federal leader, has in the House now, has been really working at that and also restoring some protocol and decorum within the House itself, which has degenerated often to sort of grade five bickering and mudslinging, you know, the way that a lot of, I venture to say, even, you know, international politics is even going.
Certainly,
you know,
here in Washington, D.C. I mean, interest, belief, support of our government is at an all-time low. It's pathetic, and it's does not bode well for agreements on these, you know, universal, you know, pressing, urgent issues like climate change, and you know what's happening to our oceans related to climate change, and then overfishing. I mean, just if you just look at what's going on the green front, you can go into despair saying, what are we, our leaders are not leading and when we need it most. And you think that, you know, environmental issues, which impact everyone, would bring us together and would get democracy, you know, really working as it should. Instead, we're, you know, seeing stalemates, impasse, dysfunction, and that's really disturbing. Although maybe things have to get so bad, maybe we're almost there before they can start improving.
Yes. The darkest hour is just before the dawn. I think that there's great, although I'm not the most high-tech person, there's great optimism to be gleaned from watching what's happening on the so-called social network, the whole Facebook thing and the whole Occupy thing. I think there's cause for optimism there, that people are being connected, and there's sort of a new weird democracy emerging just
on the internet. We are connecting.
So you have to be a little bit careful with that, because I wonder if people are actually using their hands out in communities if they're just Facebooking too.
So using our hands instead of our feet to vote, as they say, instead of out there marching and congregating where we can see each other. And there's something, I think that's what was so profoundly moving about the tar sands protests, you know, at the White House. 1,200 people arrested, including scientists, educators, not just environmental activists. God bless them, you know, for getting all those people out there. But it felt very refreshing just to see so many faces in one place.
Well, even Naomi Klein. I often wondered, you know, if authors like that are just sequestered with a computer in their writing room, or but she's out there getting
arrested. Maybe, but she was out there, and she wrote a fabulous article on capitalism versus climate change that I recommend everyone read.
Yes,
if you haven't seen it yet, from The Nation.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lynn, when we were having our, I think, two-hour conversation after my presentation, when I was in Thunder Bay, you talked about some really pressing, you know, issues regarding forest protection and new mining efforts. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's the we give that the name the Ring of Fire. That's in where we are here. We're kind of sitting in Thunder Bay, right on Lake Superior. But Northern Ontario is really vast. We use that word a lot. It goes up, you know, hundreds of miles north, right up to the Hudson's Bay coast. And so, kind of midway up, a new development is being planned called the Ring of Fire, and it would be, apparently it's the largest chromite deposit, I think, in the world. And it's going to be, you know, it's in the works right now. It hasn't gone ahead, but it's right in the boreal forest, kind of the northern limits of that, comparable in many ways to the tar sands. So it may be even on that kind of a scale. It's a different kind of thing. It would be more of a conventional mine for chromite. But, you know, there's a lot of issues about that. And the major one, as in the case of many of these things, including that proposed pipeline project out west, the only people you have living in those areas are First Nations, so the Native people, very small, isolated Native communities. So these issues are huge because it's a question of their rights. In this particular area, Northern Ontario, we have treaties that we negotiated, you know, maybe 100 or so years ago. The idea from their perspective was that the lands were to be shared. That isn't the way it's panned out, probably the same, you know, as in the U.S. In many locations. Not everywhere has treaties, and if this, the pipeline goes west in British Columbia, there's no treaties. That's a slightly different situation. But here, that's what's huge. And so all of these developments where we extract these kinds of resources, forests, mining, are in these traditional territories of First Nations. So it's just really leading up to be just such a battle, really. And maybe Scott can talk more about that.
No, well, I mean, you touch on an essential point for me, too. Another area of big interest for me is our Aboriginal rights. And, you know, we're kind of, you know, We often see them from an administrative standpoint. They're kind of in the way of resources, and of course that's a very cynical way of putting it, but that's not far off the mark. And yet we are really in their traditional territories. We are sort of the uninvited guest, as it were, and they're very conscious that they're still beginning. They believe that they're still being colonized. The radical Aboriginal activists that I'm in conversation with very much use that kind of terminology, that they're being colonized as we speak, and they're in relationship with us given that perception on things. But as Lynn has kind of uncovered here, I mean, a lot of these industrial development issues need to first address the fiduciary or federal responsibilities we have to our Aboriginal peoples, because they'll affect entire communities. Some of these communities are as small as 50 people, and some of them are as large as 1,500. But there's a vast Anishinaabeg nation throughout northwestern Ontario here that needs to be addressed in when they look at this development of the new mining, the Ring of Fire development.
And also alive and well in your part of the world, I saw, was the NIMBY factor. There was a couple of instances of wind farms that were supposed to go up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have one successfully installed wind farm close to Thunder Bay, but in a fairly remote region that's well set back from the communities, and it was installed with a lot of good upfront negotiation between the company and it's a different company than the one that's proposing in Thunder Bay, but they negotiated with the communities and the First Nations people, and they got them successfully installed. I went for a tour of that one, and Renewable Energy Systems, Renewable Energy Solutions, rather. They've installed it, and I noticed that the main stem that supports the propeller of these wind generators looked very much like the size and dimension of a pipeline. And I asked the PR fellow, and he said, "Oh yeah, these are made by Enbridge." And right away, you say, "Well, oh, geez, you know, here's this green energy form, but it's coming from the oil barons," and somebody pointed out to me that I'm rather naive to expect that anybody else would have the money to morph into these green things. So we have to always ask the sponsoring thought, who's behind these things and what is the intention, because they're actually selling energy back to our own grids with an energy form.
And while there is a dark side and certainly lots of opportunity for corruption and greed there,
yes.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if all the oil companies made, you know, wholesale change and started
right.
really investing in green energy? And that's, of course, the main argument against the tar sands. You know, is this the way of the future? Is this the way to go? Is this a place to, you know, invest our resources?
Well, this is the problem, kind of back to the Green Party stance, and not necessarily perhaps just the Green Party, but we know that best and support that direction. We don't want, not only expansion of those kind of projects like the tar sands, which they want to do, but we want, which has been dropped, like enhancing our funding and restoring it with this federal government, you know, for renewable energy and energy conservation. We used to have a little bit, or it was starting to get going. Everything has been dropped with this government. You know, there's just no focus, really, in any major way, any comprehensive programs on energy conservation and then renewables. So those are such big pieces of this issue, and we just don't have that happening now.
And we just have a couple more minutes, so let's just focus on the weather for a moment. I happen to be doing the program today from Lake Tahoe on the border between California and Nevada.
Right.
It's almost Christmas. There should be lots of snow everywhere. In fact, there's no snow. The only snow is manufactured snow up on the mountain. We've been up here since this past weekend, and my family vacation. I am not skiing. First of all, I'm busy working, but I also, something about manufactured snow does not call me at all. The sun is shining bright. The skies are blue. There's no sign of any snow on the trees and the parking lots on the ground at all.
Yeah.
This is most unusual. Then last year we had a ton of snow. And this is, you know, welcome to climate change, where it's unpredictable.
Absolutely.
It's extreme. And businesses are going out of business because the retailers, you know, have off seasons they have to survive. This is their big season. And there's no snow forecast.
Absolutely.
How's the weather there?
It's we have a little bit of snow on the ground, but it's been so mild. We had one of the warmest falls ever, and I think it's everywhere, Betsy. I was just out in the East Coast. I just came back, and what you say, this image came to mind. I flew over, actually, it was yesterday afternoon, from the East Coast, and all the way across, I'm pretty sure I was looking down at the window, crossing over Vermont, and I saw just what you're talking about. It was barren of snow everywhere across, and yet there were a couple of ski hills there in those eastern mountains with snow, and I thought, okay, the snow is made, but it's everywhere across the country. We've gotten a little bit, but really minimal levels. I think it's barely freezing, the temperature today
out
there.
Temperatures here are in the 50s, which is spring skiing conditions.
Yeah.
At Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we have open rivers and barely ankle-deep snow, which is unheard of up here.
You'd think that that's something that average folks can relate to, is the weather is definitely changing. And by now, you'd have to be living under a rock without snow to not know, you know, that we're seeing some shift in our climate. And yet, do you think people are connecting those dots in your neck of the woods?
I think not. Often, average folks are tiptoeing between the car and the shopping mall. Sorry, but I mean, it's good to connect these dots. There's some real stuff happening, and you point out a really obvious indicator is the weather, and people don't. We've become very divorced. With every little layer of extra iPad technology we add on to things, we divorce ourselves one more layer from the earth. You know.
Yeah.
We're not just outside, chopping wood and hauling water like we used to.
And we're just about out of time, so I would like to know if there's websites or, you know, places we Americans can find you folks, since we do have the World Wide Web to connect us.
We have websites.
Or anything.
I haven't quite evolved to the point of a personal website, but you can certainly, I've sent you my connection to yours, and I guess that's as good as it gets for me, and you can go to www.luradio.ca and catch my radio show Friday afternoons.
That's what I was after. Is it called The Shift, Scott, the name of your program?
It's called The Paradigm Shift Cafe.
Paradigm Shift Cafe. It's a great program, and you and I have been exchanging emails, and you write at length, you know, your concerns, and you're very thoughtful, very deep thinker, both of you. So I just want to say I'm honored to know you. So wonderful to have met you.
Betsy, if I may reciprocate and say thank you for all your green warriorship down there with your program too, and I hear that you might be chopping the lines from the dock for a while at least. But
well, I'm hoping to stay on, but I got to tell you, this wonderful Progressive Radio Network is a nonprofit labor of love from Gary Null, and God bless him, and wonderful programs out there. But alas, I, like everybody else, have to make a living. So unless I can find some way to get this really on the radar big time, which I'm open to doing, and getting so many so much traffic that we can you know, parlay into something that can attract advertisers, it's tough to continue the good fight. But we'll see. We'll see. It, it's up for grabs. And thank you so much for joining us. And happy holidays. And let's hope for a saner 2012.
Okay. Take care, Betsy. Thank
Betsy.
You.
Saner and greener. Uh-huh. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with someone who I'm sure will be provoking some thought. He is a Republican, I believe a moderate, maybe conservative, but he's trying to modernize the Republican Party. Ken Silver will join us. He's a contact from D.R. Tucker. And just to show we don't just have the choir on, we have people out, and that, of course, makes for more interesting interviews. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Green Front.